From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Department of Homeland Security is investigating the treatment of Haitian migrants by Border Patrol agents in Del Rio, Texas. Thousands of migrants have been camping out under a bridge there in brutal conditions. The Biden administration has started flying some of them back to Haiti, causing an uproar within his party. And footage shows Border Patrol agents on horseback chasing some of the migrants as if corralling them, using their reins, which to many look like whips. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said he was horrified by the images, but in his press conference at the border, clarified they were not whips.
To ensure control of the horse, long reins are used, but we are going to investigate the facts to ensure that the situation is as we understand it to be, and if it's anything different, we will respond accordingly.
Washington Post border correspondent Arelis Hernandez is in Texas. And Arelis, were you there at this moment we see on video?
I actually did not see it, but many of my colleagues did. And I was in, you know, a similar place just a day before and saw a similar dynamic, except, you know, the agents were not on their horses. But this was, it seems to have been an effort, an ongoing effort to clear areas of the river that are being used by the migrants for, you know, for access either to cross back into Mexico to buy things or, you know, to clean or to bathe by the river. And I saw something similar the day before where you had Texas state troopers actually, you know, yelling at and asking migrants to move out of the spillway. They're trying to control, you know, the in and out of the camp, but it looks like things really got out of hand there.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of sound of, again, these agents yelling at the migrants. Yes, perhaps a difficult job of trying to keep them on one side of the border, but here are some of the things that they were yelling. Let's listen.
Hey, you use your women? This is why your country because you use your women for this.
Are you familiar with that sentiment? I mean, what does that reflect?
I think that reflects a lot of frustration, and by no means am I, you know, being an apologist for Border Patrol agents here, but there is an extreme amount of frustration and pretty low morale that I've heard from among Border Patrol agents, and to some degree, right, single adults who travel to the United States and cross illegally or unlawfully or try to claim asylum by crossing the river, for the most part, do not have the same amount of success that families do, for example. Like the people who are being placed on deportation flights, for example, right now to Port-au-Prince are normally single adults. And so when families travel together, it's a totally different process and a total different consideration. And I believe what that sounds like to me is some frustration on the part of the agents that, you know, these folks are going to be released into the country by virtue of their being a family unit, by virtue of being people who cannot be easily expelled out of the country. And that's something I've heard repeatedly from Border Patrol agents. I've also heard from former Border Patrol agents. Frustration's high, morale's low.
Right. Well, and, you know, this sense that women and children would be brought into the country and cared for, it sounds like that's what he was expressing. But I just want to be clear here. Border Patrol agents are often on horseback. What do they normally use horses for?
To go through tough terrain, parts of the Rio Grande River, it's tough country. It's not easy to get through. It's thick brush. It's used to track groups who might be crossing the river and trying to evade capture and are doing so by moving through the brush. And so it's just one of the many forms of transportation that Border Patrol agents have at their disposal to carry out their duties.
Yeah. And we've reported on this. People, I'm sure, have heard at this point that these are Haitian immigrants, many of whom fled Haiti after the 2010 earthquake and have been spending 11 years making their way through dangerous situations in other countries to this border. This is a different migrant crisis on the border than we've seen in the past. Thousands of these Haitians camped out under a bridge in sweltering heat. What sentiments are you picking up on the U.S. side of the border as you go to San Antonio and other places? Are there people who maybe have, you know, a little more sympathy for this group of migrants, you know, who some of them now are being sent back to Haiti, which just was devastated by a hurricane?
Yeah, no, it's a mix of sentiments. I think that the city of Del Rio is generally frustrated, and I get that through their elected officials. They're frustrated. They feel like they've been alerting the federal government that something like this could happen, that they would be quickly overwhelmed. It's a town of about, or a city, I should say, of 35,000 to about 40,000 people, but there's only one non-governmental agency in the city that is available to help people, and it offers no sort of overnight services. It's not a shelter in the same way that you would see somewhere in like the Rio Grande Valley, for example, where you have huge number one for crossings on the southwest border. At the same time, there is, you know, a lot of goodwill and a lot of effort amongst people within these communities, both San Antonio, Del Rio, and other South Texas community, to try and welcome these folks. I mean, their migration stories started a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these Haitian immigrants have been looking for home for a long time, and they're going to go where they think they're going to have an opportunity. You know, at one point that was South America, and now it's Del Rio, Texas, in terms of being able to get entree into the country.
Yeah, that's Washington Post border correspondent Arelis Hernandez in Texas. Arelis, thank you.
Thank you.
Some vaccine news now on the Johnson & Johnson inoculation. A booster shot can provide up to 94% protection against getting sick with COVID-19. So says new data from the company. Dr. Lena Wen joins us by Skype. She's emergency physician and visiting professor of health policy at George Washington University. Dr. Wen, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Great to join you.
Now, we should first say you are a participant in this trial, as I understand it. What is the big takeaway for you, and how well the Johnson & Johnson booster seems to work?
Well, the big takeaway for me is that a booster dose does appear to be needed, regardless of whether you got the Pfizer, Moderna, or Johnson & Johnson vaccine. You are well protected if you got the one-dose J&J vaccine, but if you get a booster dose, you are even better protected. There is a very strong antibody response after the second dose. Also, individuals who got the two-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine as opposed to the one-dose are better protected when it comes to symptomatic illness and when it especially comes to severe illness. But that said, here's what I don't think the takeaway is. I don't think the takeaway is that people who got the one-dose J&J vaccine have to go out and only get a second dose of J&J. There are mix-and-match studies being done by the NIH, and I know that for me, especially as a woman under the age of 50, because of the very serious side effect of the blood clotting disorder associated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, I think I would rather wait until I see the other data.
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned this, because when the J&J shot first came out, I remember it had a lower protective rate than the Pfizer, the Moderna vaccine. So for people who got the Johnson & Johnson shot, how do they pair that data with this new data? How do they kind of put it together and decide what to do?
I think it's difficult because right now our federal health officials are not able to make any recommendations on a mix and match regimen. And that's because all the data are coming from pharmaceutical companies themselves, who are not going to be doing the mix and match studies. The NIH is doing these studies, and other countries like UK and Germany are recommending that particular approach.
Okay, so just to avoid confusion here, when you're talking about the potential of mix and match, what patients should even think about that question in the U.S.?
I think that an individual right now who received the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine who is particularly high risk, let's say an older individual with chronic medical conditions, maybe they live at home with somebody who is unvaccinated and is exposing them to high risk, that individual should speak with their doctor now about whether a booster shot may be recommended, including especially a booster shot with the Pfizer vaccine, because that is what has received full approval. I think everybody else could wait until the second dose of Johnson & Johnson is authorized by the FDA or further mix and match results are officially out.
Okay. And let's talk about the timing here on boosters in general. Last Friday, scientists advising the FDA recommended the Pfizer booster only for people over 65 and at higher risk. The CDC has a meeting on this question this week. How far off do you think boosters are for the general population? And how far off for children between 5 and 11?
I think many people have already taken matters into their own hands to get an unauthorized booster. The CDC result or CDC data show that about 2 million people have already done this. I really think that this is only a matter of time before boosters are allowed for a larger group of people. You mentioned people over 65. Also, I hope the CDC will come to a broader recommendation and allow boosters for individuals who perceive themselves to be at high risk. When it comes to children, I'm very optimistic about the results that Pfizer released yesterday. I am hopeful that they'll submit for authorization very soon, that the FDA will then take several weeks to review these data. The most optimistic projections of timing are that children 5 to 11 could start receiving the vaccine as early as Halloween.
Finally, let me throw in a question on the flu shot. What's your recommendation on getting it and when?
People should get the flu shot as soon as it's available to them. If you are getting a COVID booster, there's no reason to wait, as in you can do both of those things at the same time. We know that people are getting together more this winter. Also, why not prevent something else that could also cause substantial suffering and illness?
Dr. Lita Nguyen, emergency physician and visiting professor of health policy at George Washington University. Thanks, doctor, as always.
Thank you.
A trove of internal documents from Facebook reveals what the company knew about problematic messages on its platform and how it's trying to fix things. We should note Facebook is a sponsor of NPR. The Wall Street Journal is reporting a series called The Facebook Files. Sam Schechner is on the reporting team, and he joins us. Sam, welcome.
Hello.
Sam, I want to delve into vaccine misinformation and what you found. But first, the whole series reveals Facebook's own research revealing damaging effects on teen images and human trafficking and promoting discord in general. Can you first describe the documents you obtained and what they tell you?
What we have is a collection of internal communications that give us what we think is an unparalleled picture of how Facebook is aware that the products and systems central to its business routinely fail and cause harm. The kinds of documents we're talking about are internal PowerPoint-style presentations, also a sort of version of Facebook that they use to actually run the business. They have a workplace version of Facebook, and so you'll have documents and posts posted there, and then their responses from other Facebook employees.
Yeah, so you got this look into the inside of the company, and let me ask you what the inside conversation has been about vaccine information and what they know on the inside about it. I mean, has it been clear to the executives on the inside of Facebook that vaccine information has been a big problem?
Well, what we know from the documents is that at least among a group of data scientists who are mostly part of a team called the Integrity Team, they definitely were aware of a problem. So, you know, for instance, the same time as Mark Zuckerberg this spring was out there talking about how the company had, quote, already connected more than 2 billion people to authoritative COVID-19 information, you had data scientists inside who were describing, quote, cesspools of anti-vaccine comments. You know, posts from UNICEF or the World Health Organization would sometimes, as the documents say, be swarmed by anti-vaccine comments. There was one analysis we saw where data scientists internally concluded that roughly 41% of comments on English language vaccine-related posts risked discouraging vaccinations. They were, to use Facebook lingo, vaccine hesitant. And users were seeing comments on vaccine-related posts 775 million times a day.
Yeah. I want to play you a little piece of sound. Last month, Gail King of CBS asked Mark Zuckerberg about research from Northwestern University that said people who were the most reliant on Facebook for information were less likely to be vaccinated. Here's part of his answer.
If this were primarily a question about social media, then I think you'd see that being the effect in all of these countries where people use it. But I think that there's something that's unique in our ecosystem here, whether it's some of the political leaders or some of the media figures, that I think is different than what we're seeing across a lot of Europe or across a lot of other countries that are leading to higher levels of this. So I don't think pinning this on social media primarily is accurate.
So Mark, Dr. Zuckerberg is suggesting that some of this at least is about politics in the U.S., but how does that square with your reporting?
Well, the political environment in which social media exists seems highly relevant to what occurs on the platform. That being said, there's clearly alarm here in terms of how widespread this sentiment was, far outpacing the level of vaccine hesitancy that polls at the time were showing. And the company scrambled to try and take on this problem by, limiting the number of comments that people could do per hour, which I think is an indication that they saw this as a problem and not merely a reflection of what happens on cable news.
And is it your sense things might be starting to change? I mean, you're describing there's evidence of disproportionate, amplifying of vaccine misinformation on Facebook, that they're aware of it, that they're trying to change things. And then there's this public outrage on this, right? Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut compares this to big tobacco back in the day, targeting people with dangerous information while masking the science in public and privately, kind of knowing what's really going on here. Is there any sense that there's going to be fundamental change at Facebook, its algorithm, and what we're going to see?
Well, that's a very good question. There certainly is internally, from our reporting, an awareness that the company is often late to tackling problems. I mean, one document that we read talked about how Facebook, tends to act late in their point of view in evolving situations, that they take minimal action at first, and then once there's an outcry, they suddenly rush and at times overreact, leading to further backlash. And they were hoping that COVID would prove a chance for the company to act earlier and perhaps avoid this cycle. But we've spoken to people familiar with a gathering earlier this month in and around Menlo Park, which is where Facebook is based. Mm-hmm. And some officials were discussing whether Facebook has gotten too big with too much data flowing to manage all of its content. The tone from some participants was, quote, "We created the machine and we can't control the machine." And so that does raise the question of whether they are starting to internally think about changing some of the governance or ways they handle these issues.
Sam Schechner is senior tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We will link to your investigation on our site, hereandnow.org. Sam, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's how many have died of COVID-19 in the U.S. on average every day over the past week, a number that hasn't been that high since this past winter. That's when Jessica Alejandro of Queens, New York, lost her grandfather to COVID-19. Joseph Anthony Sulkowitz was 78. Jessica says he was eligible to get vaccinated, but it was a chaotic time when vaccines weren't easily available, and he was holding out to get one from his doctor. He was still on a waiting list when he died. Well, as part of our COVID-19 remembrances, today we asked Jessica to remember her papa.
I lost my papa, my grandfather, Joseph Anthony Sulkowitz, March 8th, 2021. So I lost him 6 months ago. So he was a house painter for years, forever. And he actually worked up until his last days, until he was diagnosed with COVID. So he was a hard worker and he continued until the end. He was like a kid at heart, and we jet skied in Puerto Rico and parasailed in Hawaii. And we, vacationed to Universal Studios and did things like that. Originally, he only listened to doo-wop in the car. He always listened to this oldies station. And he used to drive my sister and I to school, and that's all we would hear. And we were like, you know, why don't you try something different? Like, there's other songs we think you would like. And he used to fight with us all the time. But then he transitioned into listening to pop music. There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch. And that's how, you know, he got into Adele and Sam Smith and Lady Gaga. Those are his top three artists. And we were thinking of Rolling in the Deep by Adele. That's one of those songs that popped into our heads because we remember the chorus, just how goofy we would be singing the chorus and belting it out. You know, it usually comes on when, you know, something is going on, whether good or bad. And it's like, okay, Papa's here. You know, we're very spiritual and we know that he's around us. And it's always like weird times or good times or, you know, random times. And, you know, it's like he's just saying hello. So, you know, music is definitely a huge part of our relationship. You know, I just want him to be remembered as a hard worker and he would do anything and everything for his family and just had such a zest and a love for life. And it wasn't until long after, you know, his funeral and his burial and everything, he was a Marine. So he had a beautiful, you know, ceremony. You know, it wasn't until after all of that died down that everything really hit us because we were on overdrive. So after everything happened, the grief started kicking in, and day by day, you know, you learn to live with it. Time doesn't heal wounds. That's something that we definitely learned. It doesn't heal wounds. It just makes them more bearable. And we're trying to take our experience and our pain and trying to be there for others who have gone through the same thing and who really need somebody there for them and their families in that time of confusion.
Jessica Alejandro of Queens, New York, remembering her grandfather, Joseph Anthony Sulkowitz, who died of COVID-19 last March at 78. Now Jessica and her sister Danielle, both students at Queens College, are putting together a support group for the campus community so everyone can grieve loved ones lost during the pandemic. Today, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is savoring what he's calling a victory in yesterday's parliamentary elections.
I see Canadians standing together, together in your determination to end this pandemic, together for real climate action, for $10 a day childcare, for homes that are in reach for middle-class families.
Trudeau called this snap election because voters gave his government high marks for handling COVID-19, but voters did not seem to approve of the move and gave him a slim victory, awarding him with a minority government and a parliament that looks like it did before. Chris Hall is here from Toronto. He's the host of the House CBC Radio 1's weekly politics program. And Chris, you've helped us on this before. So for those not glued to Canadian politics, these are parliamentary politics. Have I got it right in kind of the setup of how this came about?
That's right. Justin Trudeau forced this election because he thought he could win. He could get a majority. Instead of that, he ended up getting a minority. Now, the difference is a majority government, you get to push through your legislative agenda without having to rely on another party to do so. In a minority, he will have to continue to rely on one of the opposition parties to get his legislation passed. The other thing is, in this election campaign, the Conservatives, the official opposition now, actually got more votes. So in our parliamentary system, Well, that's the equivalent, I guess, in a football game of one team getting far more yards on offense but still coming out on the short end of the score. So the country remains divided geographically, and the liberal strength is in the cities of this country. He will have a lot of work ahead of him.
Actually, it feels a lot like our electoral college in the popular vote.
Yeah, we'll exactly.
Just put that aside. And let's hear a little from Trudeau's chief rival. This is the Conservative Party leader, Erin O'Toole, speaking last night after the party failed to win Parliament.
Mr. Trudeau thinks Canadians should endure 18 more months of divisive campaigning so he can try once again to get the election result he wants. We need to heal the divides in Canada, not risk worsening them.
And Chris, we're reminded, you know, this is a parliamentary government. Can they force Trudeau's hand in effect, they, you know, lose confidence in him and force him to call yet another election sooner than scheduled?
That's right. They could force an election, but I don't actually have that census today, Robin. This is, of course, just the day after. The third and fourth place parties, the Bloc Québécois, which is a sovereigntist party in the province of Quebec, and the New Democratic Party, which is a left-leaning, more social democratic party, they have shown support for many of Trudeau's policies that he identified in the clip you played, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, creating more affordable housing across the country, quality childcare spaces, improving the lives of seniors. So Justin Trudeau, you know, can only probably afford to force an election in his own hand the once. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking that the other opposition parties, because of the cost of running a campaign, will be prepared to work with him. The only question we have now is what kind of price will they demand in return for that support?
In less than a minute. Anything else we should know?
Yeah, watch for some of the, when Parliament comes back, watch for some of these issues that Canada might be foreign to a U.S. audience, but for example, a universal drug care program. That's a big thing for the New Democrats. Mm. Le Québécois would like more money for health care with no strings attached, so the province of Quebec can invest it where it wants. Those are the kinds of things that will be a flashpoint, I think, as we look ahead to this Parliament.
And Chris Hall, gee, we never have problems with our elections. I don't know why you guys are struggling so. He hosts the weekly political show, The House, on CBC Radio 1. Chris, thank you.
You're welcome.
In rural Afghanistan, away from the chaos of Kabul, the Taliban takeover, or re-takeover, has prompted indifference or even welcome by villagers. For them, the U.S. pullout means peace after 20 years of war killed more than 47,000 Afghan civilians. Yaroslav Trofimov of the Wall Street Journal has been sitting down with rural Afghans, and he joins us. Yaroslav, welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be in the show.
Yaroslav, you went to a place called Baraki Barak. Can you situate this place for us? What does it look like? What's the toll of 20 years of war?
Yeah, it's a valley south of Kabul, about an hour and a half drive now that you can drive. And it's a lush place, and it has been one of the hotbeds of the Taliban insurgency for much of the 20-year U.S. Presence in the country. And it was impossible to go there as a civilian just a month and a half ago. Mm. So now, all of a sudden, there's peace there. And that's a great change because every day for the last two decades, most of the last two decades, there was fighting in one or another of the villages there, fighting with the American forces that used to have a base there, fighting with the Afghan forces, Afghan commandos. And in fact, it was the site of one of the very last night raids of the war just 4 days before the fall of Kabul.
Mm. And so you went there. How did the people there talk about the peace now? Is it just the absence of this daily fighting that you describe? Are they welcoming the Taliban?
Well, it's one of those places where there was fighting precisely because the Taliban have a strong degree of local support and were able to maintain this insurgency despite, you know, the U.S. military surge, despite repeated offensives by the Afghan army. So a lot of local villagers agree with, you know, the conservative social codes of the Taliban. And the ones who don't agree, a lot of them, sort of, people who are used to be caught in the crossfire, the absence of this crossfire is life-changing. All of a sudden, you know, they no longer have to be afraid when they go to the market, they travel to Kabul. They can be in their fields at night without being struck by an airstrike or by Taliban mortars or IEDs. So it's life-altering to a much greater extent than it is for the people of Kabul, where the change has been mostly negative because Kabul didn't really experience war. And for the citizens of Kabul, many of whom are educated, much more liberal than the Taliban, the Taliban takeover meant the sort of decreasing freedoms, and has meant that, you know, women can no longer work, have to cover up, you know, girls can no longer go to school in the middle of high school. So it's a lot of negatives. Mm. However, in some of these villages, this sense of sudden peace outweighs all these other changes.
Now, you mentioned this strong local support in the place you went to for the Taliban. Does that include this cultural worldview that is aligned, say, on the role of women?
Well, you know, the Taliban are not monolithic. Mm. So the views on the role of women in places like Kandahar in the south and in places like Baraki Barak, which is within the pool of Greater Kabul, are different. The local Taliban commander there told me, you know, women are allowed to be in the streets without a male guardian. It's not a problem, though it's desirable to have one. You know, women are allowed to go to high schools, even though not have been opened yet because the Taliban Ministry of Education hasn't allowed that yet. And the Taliban there were locals. Most of them were from that area and have been there for a very long time.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I just wonder, and you have some great specific illustrative quotes in your story. One of them from a village elder says, "When someone doesn't feel danger, doesn't fear war, and can walk with a peace of mind, he's happy, even when he is hungry." I wonder if you have another kind of anecdote or conversation about this that really stays with you.
Right. Well, you know, this war also took a very dramatic economic toll. You know, people talked about, you know, their cows being struck during the nitrates or in the fighting. People are quite poor, so for them, a cow is livelihood. You know, people talk about the doors because, you know, they live in mud homes. So when a door that is expensive for an average family there gets damaged in nitrate, that's a huge cost that many cannot afford. And obviously, there are medical costs. You know, I spoke to a villager who had to borrow a fantastical sum of money, you know, thousands of dollars, which for all Afghanistan is unimaginable.
Yeah.
Because he and his son were injured in one of his last nitrates.
Wow. Now, you were reporting in a certain Taliban stronghold. I imagine other rural areas might be a little different. Are there places where villagers might fear the iron fist of the Taliban?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's really, there's an inversion of roles now. So the places that used to be the most insecure are now the most secure, such as Baraki Barak. And the places that used to be safe, such as the Panjshir Valley, are now the least safe, because that's where the Taliban never had much local support. This was always the stronghold of resistance. And this Panjshir Valley even tried to resist after the fall of Kabul. Mm. That didn't work out very well. The Taliban massed their forces and entered it at the end of the first week of September. And so there you see a very different picture. You see shuttered storefronts. You see people trying to leave. The very few are still there. And there are more Taliban fighters than civilians there. And those Taliban there are not locals. They all came from far away, don't speak local language in many cases, and really don't treat the population nicely.
And instances of outright retribution in places like the Panjshir Valley?
Well, in Panjshir, so what happened is that when the Taliban came to Kabul, they announced an amnesty. And though there have been cases of retribution against some former security officials, that is so far an exception rather than the rule. We're talking about dozens, maybe hundreds in the country of 40 million people. And Panjshir was different because the Panjshir resistance refused this amnesty and engaged in a fight, in an armed resistance, which the Taliban crushed with overwhelming force. You know, with the use of air power, they sent combat helicopters to strafe that resistance. And people were killed. People are still being killed there. We're talking about probably hundreds. There have been no reports, credible reports, of mass killings of civilians, but certainly people who are fighters have been executed.
Okay. And finally, you know, from far away, Americans can see places like Afghanistan as, you know, two sets of uniforms, right? Those who wear the jersey of the Taliban and those who wore the jersey of the Afghan army supported by the U.S. over the years. But when you go to these villages, I imagine up close it looks quite different.
Right. And even in the villages like Baraki Barak that are supportive of the Taliban generally, many of the villagers had joined the Afghan army and had fought against their neighbors, the siblings sometimes, who were in the Taliban. Yeah. That is quite common. So the reality is much more complex. But I think on every side, there is this gratitude that the war is over for the first time in 43 years, because remember, there has been a conflict in Afghanistan since the late 1970s that never really stopped. So in two generations, those villages did not know what peace means. And all of a sudden, roads are open. People can travel, you know, from Kandahar to pretty much anywhere, to Panjshir, without being stopped and without risking their lives. And it's a very new feeling that does give this sort of honeymoon period for the Taliban, who are unable to provide services, unable to have the economy running, and aren't really very good at running the state. But this relief that the killings have stopped does give them this window of opportunity for now. How long will it last? It depends on, you know, on how well the economy does in the future.
I mean, just quickly, I do have to ask you, for families that had siblings fighting on either side of this conflict, what do those families look like now? Do we have siblings who are reconciled in many cases?
Well, you know, it's siblings are reconciled. Question is sort of the wider society. And the Taliban have proclaimed an amnesty, and they, you know, fighters you talk to will say, yes, we forgive them, but we don't forget them. And the fear is, for many on the other side, on the losing side, is that this amnesty will not last, and at some point in the future, a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, this course will be settled. Mm. And so in Barak-e-Barak, you know, the villagers who were in the army came back to the village, looked around, you know, they were told they are forgiven, but nobody really stayed there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is Yaroslav Trofimov, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Fascinating observations. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
Today, House Democrats submitted a bill to suspend the debt ceiling, the limit on how much the government is allowed to borrow, for 1 year, and to fund the government until December. They'd hoped to have a bipartisan agreement on raising the spending limit, but there are just 9 days left for Congress to do that. If there's no resolution by the end of this month, it could lead to a government shutdown. And Senate Minority Leader, the Republican Mitch McConnell, has made it plain. He says Democrats are on their own, having put forth that 10-year, $3.5 trillion spending plan. Okay, is your head spinning? Let's bring in Robin Farzad. He's the host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure to give us a little explainer here. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
Well, I'm okay, except, you know, a government shutdown, no good. So first, the debt ceiling. It's a regular political football. What is it? And how did we this time get to this point where we're once again hearing this Chicken Little, but it may not be Chicken Little, may be real. You know, the sky is falling, the debt ceiling, we're going to be in trouble.
I just think that playing chicken with the debt ceiling has become a regular political problem. It's become fair game in our ultra-partisan times. Otherwise, Robin, going back to 1960, Capitol Hill has raised it 78 times and 49 times under GOP presidents. The federal debt limit simply allows the U.S. to continue financing existing obligations. I mean, cutting checks for everything from Social Security and Medicare to military pay and tax refunds. It's been changed almost 100 times since the end of World War II.
Well, but this is what Democrats are saying. We've always worked together to keep the government running. But Republicans are saying this time around, you have this huge spending plan, so you're on your own. But the seeds for the debt that we are seeing right now, they were, you know, planted over years, including under former President Trump's tax cut.
Yeah, I mean, you have to separate the tactical game of spend now, blame later versus just kind of fiscal ledger domain. The GOP here under McConnell is arguing they want no part in fiscal profligacy. If you, as the barely Senate majority, the Democrats, use the reconciliation loophole to push through massive spending, emergency or not, pandemic or otherwise, then the thinking goes you should truly own this spree by similarly upping the debt limit purely on party lines. Of course, everyone, as you mentioned, blue or red, wants to own popular programs like Social Security and Medicare, and even emergency pandemic stimulus, credit for that, until the political tab comes due. In this case, a contentious midterm election, Robin, is a year away, and you can just imagine the appeal of running against supposed runaway fiscal irresponsibility. I mean, one-party tyranny through loophole. I'm just gaming out the tactic and messaging. Democrats, mm-hmm. for their part, insist that everyone is benefiting from the spending. I mean, so everyone should own it through a normal bipartisan extension of the debt ceiling.
Right. And we should, to elaborate on that, the Democrats are saying this kind of spending that we're talking about will make money for the country. It'll be jobs, you know, people doing infrastructure or, you know, providing health care. So we're adding to the economy with our spending. That's their claim. While they're also accusing the Republicans of not adding much to the economy with a tax cut that was largely for the very rich. So they're going back and forth with that debate. But meanwhile, you know, Americans are, you know, maybe right to wonder, oh, really? I mean, this isn't going to happen. The government really doesn't run out of money. But we understand that the Treasury already is. And Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned in a Wall Street Journal op-ed that if the debt ceiling isn't raised or suspended before October, the government will run out of money. Really? I mean, can that really happen?
Well, for starters, U.S. credibility, it atrophies every time this happens. And more immediately, if you want to get down to brass tacks, people vying for a mortgage in a very difficult housing market, they could get priced out. Checks are going to be delayed. If you're on Social Security, you could be check to check to pay expenses, to buy groceries. What about all the private contractors, the building janitors and security people in emptied federal buildings? There's no shortage of instant pain, however, quote, collateral it's considered by lawmakers.
Yeah. In other words, yeah, you can just print money, but there are laws here, and that's what we're dealing with, what those laws require. Is there also fear about the markets?
I think they've become quite inured to the ritual, actually. You think about it, Robin. We had our credit downgraded in 2011. It was so unthinkable. It felt so shocking and taboo at the time. But markets have really rallied over 10 years, and U.S. debt remains the world's redoubt of safety. Our debt outstanding has skyrocketed since that debt downgrade. But there's clearly a cry wolf element to this. And if the U.S. debt, which, you know, is the world's go-to benchmark for more than a century, if it's suddenly looked at as risky, if we're suddenly looked at as not being good for what we promised, every asset across the planet is going to feel it.
We've got about a half minute here. What's your bet on what's going to happen?
I think they take it to hour 11 and a half or like 11:57 p.m. Mm-hmm. Are you going to see global markets crash or D.C. and various federal buildings across the land brace for another furlough? Who then takes the bulk of the blame? Who blinks first? Sadly, it's about the politics, not the policy.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Heads are still spinning, though. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Scott Tong. You're listening to Here and Now.